Babel Radio, recorded on Friday, June 21st, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, our theme was Off the Hill, Pride in Canada, The Fight Continues. Our panel featured NDP MP Blake Desjarlais, Rabble columnist Charlotte Dalwood, podcaster Sean Dern, Professor Fritz Pino, and activist Martine Roy. This is a small clip from our panel, though please be aware that due to technical difficulties we faced on this week's live panel, and in an effort to include all five panelists, this clip has been edited and modified. Take a listen.
So I'm going to begin actually with Sean and Martine. And Sean, first to you, as the creator and host of the podcast Queer Legends, which has been hugely successful, you discuss the many injustices towards the LGBT community by the federal government over many, many decades, including Canada's LGBT purge. So maybe just to start us off, can you give us a bit of history on what the LGBT purge is?
Well, that's a really long, long answer, but I'll try and squish it down to something more manageable. It started in 1948 when Canada created a new vetting process after the Second World War, and it was designed to get rid of communists everywhere in Canadian society. And it ended up going so well, according to government documents, that they ended up having to sort of move their gaze, if you'll pardon the pun, to somewhere else. And it was because they got so good at getting rid of communists. The communists then started relying on things that were called sexual deviations or human weaknesses. And by that, they meant anyone who was gay or lesbian. And so what happened as a result of that, the Soviets and the spies and all the communists started going after gays and lesbians, trying to find all of their dirty secrets. But at the same time, the government started creating anti-gay policies. And they implemented these things. And what ended up happening, it was a brutal and violent witch hunt that basically started in 1948 and lasted right up until 1992-ish. A lot of people think that it kind of ended then, when in fact the documentary series that I put together for season two of Queer Legends really indicates that that wasn't the case. And in fact, we had quite a lot of discrimination and homophobia continuing in the military, the RCMP, right up until the early 2000s. And so what happened, people lost their jobs. People were interrogated by the RCMP. If you could imagine, go to work, you're sitting at your desk doing your thing, and then all of a sudden two folks in suits appear next to you, and they're RCMP officers, and they take you off to some weird place you've never seen, usually a small house or a small office somewhere. There's, you know, egg cartons on the wall for sound and a light hanging from the ceiling. And you were interrogated for hours and hours. And this would go on multiple times over multiple days even. It's an ongoing injustice that lasted all that period of time. And finally, thanks to folks like Martine Roy, who you'll hear from in a second, they helped bring an apology and there was an end to the purge and policies began to change. But it's still an ongoing battle, as we're going to hear later today or in this show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sean. First of all, that was an incredibly succinct history. And honestly, I think a history that a lot of Canadians don't know about. So the fact that you're doing your podcast and that, you know, there's information coming out through the Purge Fund and various projects is really fantastic, because it is exposing this incredible discrimination and even people who took their own lives, right? Yes, I know there are stories of diplomats who took their own lives, of people in the military, yep, because they were so persecuted. So, yes, we're going to go to Martine next. And Martine, you're a survivor of the LGBT purge. And in 2016, you helped launch a nationwide class action lawsuit against the Canadian government. It was very successful. Maybe you could share a little bit of your experience about going through that lawsuit and getting to the point where there was an official apology. And if there's time to just tell us a little bit about the book that's being written that was mentioned by Sven, because I know it's a project of the Purge Fund, but we'd love to get a little sneak peek at a book that we know is going to come out.
Thank you, for sure. I don't have much information, though, about the book. He's keeping that pretty secret, I think, all along. But we did get a lot of archives to assist him. And that was one of our biggest points we did about the Purge Fund. But you have to understand that, like we said, in 92, they removed the policy, but they didn't change the culture. They didn't implement anything. So it really took 22 years before people got together and says, okay, we want to demand an apology. And it's really, we demand an apology that trigger in 2014. And we went in front of parliament in 2015 to ask for an apology in that time, but nobody even talked about it. So it's when we joined the Just Society Committee and we decided to do a class action in 2016, that thing really concretized. You know, we get a lawyer, we got law firm lawyer that got together. So we got three law firms that got together to represent us, 11 lawyers, and we went and negotiate. And it was like, for me, it was really important because, like you said, nobody heard about it. So it's almost we did something really bad that was very discriminatory. It was misogyn because it was very a lot oriented towards the man in my time. And there was, and the woman, I mean, and there was not a lot of women. There were more men. So it left it, you know, a lot of bad energy, of bad culture, and to all the federal agency. And until we talk about it, we cannot repair it. And that's the way I see it. So we're really into repairing by first admitting we did this and how we can change things and how we can change the culture, because it's really that. And they did put a culture department, but it's bigger than that. It's really something that everybody has to do. And at the end of the day, we're at work. You want you to be your authentic self because you want to be focused, right? So it's a very sad era, and it was very important for me to do something about it. I'm very grateful it worked. We did get some apology. We get some redress, like you said, the monument and all this. We get documentary like the Food Machine. There's another one. There's what Shauna did with the podcast. That's amazing, telling the story, the archive, and hopefully people's going to really talk about it, make sure we don't go back there.
Yes. Well, we certainly look forward to the book coming out, and I really encourage people to listen to Sean's podcast, because they're quite incredible to hear the stories and to get this history out there and to hear what went on. So thank you for that, Martin.
Blake, as we've outlined, Canada's federal government has a mixed record on LGBTQ rights, often only upholding rights based on court challenges, right? Like we just heard, such as the same-sex marriage in 2005. How are queer rights being championed in Parliament today, and what are some of the key milestones and advances for the queer community that stand out for you?
Yeah, thanks for that question, and Tansay, friend. It means a lot to be with all of you here today. It's not often, I think, that Indigenous voices, especially in the last 10 years, I think, have been within these spaces to speak to a really unique experience. And you spoke about some of the challenges, which is the legal system in combination with Canada's own treatment of the question of who is Canadian. Who is Canadian? Who deserves rights in Canada? Indigenous people have been largely excluded from that history for most of our lives. And we know what it means when we have to take our rights to a court in order to enforce basic things like the rights to water, the rights to having a house, the rights to having equitable pay. That's similar to the Black class action lawsuit. There's actually an Indigenous class action lawsuit as well that was filed in 2021 with very similar claims of systemic racism. It's true that Canada has picked and chose who gets rights in Canada. And for the most part of Canada's history, it's largely been those of in terms of language rights, particularly French and English. You know, we see a very strong protection of those languages, so much so that, you know, my first language, Cree, and my parents' first language, it's very difficult to sustain today. And so I know I think this is something we're reckoning with today in Parliament, is the intersectionality of Canada's own colonial history, Canada's own history of occupation in these lands, in combination with what is really a neoliberalism in a modern democracy, a modern liberal democracy, which is also a colonial democracy, which is also something that we're dealing with in the modern time. In 2024, we're dealing with these really important questions as we're starting to see indigenous people take positions of power and take positions of voice and speaking to a really difficult fact, which is we haven't been enfranchised in Canada until 1961. You know, like my mom could not vote in this country. That's a really serious thing we have to deal with in our own understanding of how rights can and cannot be recognized in Canada, which is forcing people to the courts. And I often see the work of the 2SLGBTQI plus community as the kind of crack in the Canadian shield that has allowed for so many other groups to enter and have their rights affirmed and recognized. Because what we've seen is this push for equality, this better understanding, this cultural change that Martine speaks about, which has now allowed this greater pursuit of diversity and inclusion, has now brought this cultural challenge to Canadians. And so in the House of Commons, for example, when I was first elected in 2021, I was the very first Two-Spirit member of Parliament ever elected in Canada, bringing very unique perspective, not a perspective that is, I think, very commonly found within dominant Canadian society, which is this idea of coming out of the closet, that, you know, we're coming out into this society, but that we are queer and we are part of our societies. It's integral to Indigenous nationhood. It's integral to Indigenous sovereignty. It's integral to self-determination. And the closet came with colonization. We were, you know, this idea of progress, this idea that we start at zero and go to 100, and that's Canada's history of having no rights, and then we get to a point of having all the rights. No, you know, Indigenous societies in North America had dealt with these questions long before colonization had approached our shores. We had equitable treatment of Indigenous Two-Spirit people. We had Indigenous Two-Spirit elders, leaders, governors, so much so that our societies were organized in matriarchies. You know, and it's our challenge in our history is trying to punch through the narrative and trying to find space to speak about this very different history that we've experienced in Canada, this very different understanding of who we are. And so now we're at a time where I think that, especially when it comes to the challenges we're facing in Canada, at the very beginning when I was elected, we had a conservative opposition that said, we are going to put to rest the question of conversion therapy. I remember walking across the aisle and seeing Aaron O'Toole, and he said, Blake, I know what you're going to say. Don't even have to say it. This week, we're going to pass unanimous consent to ban conversion therapy. I read your letter to me. I get it. You're upset about the fact that it died on the order paper. It didn't happen last Parliament. We're going to make it happen. We're going to make this better. Imagine that. You know, I was elated. I was like, oh, my God, like this is the first week in Parliament. We're going to do it. I've seen in a 180 shift where it's been so difficult and scary in Parliament now, where I'm the co-founder and co-chair of the Canadian Pride Caucus, the first time we had parliamentarians who are queer from all parties come together. And now we're really having a difficult time trying to keep ourselves together. An achievement of getting ourselves to the same space. Now we have members of the Conservatives boycotting us, you know, boycotting our meetings, not attending, not participating. And it gives me really serious concern. And I'll end with this. We have so much more work to do. We tabled the first ever trans white paper in Parliament, a comprehensive report on how trans people in Canada deserve a kind of protection that not only looks at their well-being and their rights, but also speaks to some really important social and pragmatic and material conditions that have to be met. Access to healthcare, access to livable and affordable livelihoods, housing. You know, we see in the streets in Canada today is an affordability crisis that is disproportionately harming trans youth. Disproportionately. Trans youth of color are on the streets at a larger rate than anyone else. And that's no secret. That's a policy choice that's happening in Canada. And so we have to be really serious about kind of the challenges that we're facing in Canada and have the courage to really meet them where they're at. It's no secret that these challenges are because of a growing sentiment. Sean spoke about it, that existed early on in Canada's history, now turning its ugly head again and seeing vulnerable people as capital for power.
Yeah, thank you, Blake.
All right, why don't we...
Robin, do you want to go to the next question?
Yeah, we're still having an audio problem with the
Your audio was a little wobbly. Could Libby, could you maybe repeat the question for the benefit of the audience? Because I had trouble hearing
okay.
it.
Okay. Yes. So basically, the question from Robin, because I know that we kind of did a run through earlier, is just talking about Pride Month in Canada and the Pride parades that will soon be taking place across the country in cities and towns. So just really wanting to sort of get into what are the ongoing debates about who and what should be part of Pride. For example, should the police be allowed to participate? Should political views be part of Pride? So we just wanted to get your take, Charlotte, on where you think the Pride parades are at, that whole movement. It has a long history in and of itself. What's your take on it today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a few questions that have been posed here. So let's start with the question of police. Should police be involved in Pride? Absolutely not. So I have the benefit of wearing multiple hats. So one of my hats is I work as a student at law at a firm called Prison and Police Law here in Calgary, where I'm based. And one of the things that we do there is we litigate and complain and make noise when the police commit misconduct. And what we know is that police commit misconduct all the time. And they commit misconduct all the time with the benefit of state protections. And so why is that? Because the police are an instrument of state violence, very often of the kind of settler colonial violence that has already been brought up in this conversation. We know that police over-police, over-surveil, disproportionately commit violence against Black, Indigenous, and other racialized communities. That affects queer communities too. And then, so that's the one hat I wear. The other hat I wear is that I happen to be a columnist for Rabble. I write a lot about the history of carceral politics in this country. And I think we can't forget that Pride, began really with the Stonewall riots in New York. And what were those a response to? A police raid in New York. So the police are not on the side of the 2SLGBTQ plus community. They have never been on the side of the 2SLGBTQ plus community. And so this idea that we should allow this instrument of state violence into our celebrations and into our demonstrations is kind of ridiculous to me. Now, the other kind of aspect to this question is, should their political views be a part of Pride? Well, Pride without politics isn't Pride. Pride is a political movement. Pride is a way of demonstrating and of making demands heard. So political views have always been a part of Pride. They need to be a part of Pride. And one of the things that we need to be doing as organizers within the 2SLGBTQ plus community is leveraging the popularity of Pride in order to advance the political goals of 2SLGBTQ plus people. So I remember last year I was at a party, event, for just before Pride Calgary, which a number of local and federal politicians were present. And the conservative MP for one of the ridings downtown Calgary was in tears at being finally welcomed into Pride Calgary. And I think that's great. He wants to be part of the Pride parade. That's wonderful. Unless the voting record of him and his party is going to support the rights and interests of 2SLGBTQ plus people, we should not be welcoming him or any other politician into our demonstrations. But the point I want to make is that politicians want to be part of this movement because it's so visible now and because it has so much cultural currency right now. We need to be leveraging that as 2SLGBTQ plus organizers to say that if you want to be with us, you need to be with us. This is a political movement. You need to be on our side. You need to be voting in a way that advances our rights and that helps our people. And we're not just going to let you in because this is just a party to which everyone is invited. So to sum up, politics absolutely should be part of Pride. Cops, not so much.
Fritz, if I could just bring you into this now. The question that we had suggested or posed to you was just to have a little bit of discussion about the trans community today and how the narrative, you know, there's seemingly a rise in hatred. It's used by the political right as a divisive issue to divide people. So just, you know, wondering if you can reflect a little bit about where does this hate come from and what can we do to combat it?
I think I mentioned before I cut off that we are still in a state of colonialism. Right.
Yes.
We are still colonized within our mindset, what it means to be trans, what it means to be queer. We are still operating dominantly from a binary perspective of gender, from cis heteronormativity, from heteropatriarchy. Patriarchy is very much shaping our institutional structures in different ways, and that continue to shape our mindset, perpetuating defending heteronormativity, defending whiteness at all fronts, at different levels, just to maintain that dominant power and status quo of dominant groups identifying with this dominant structure. So we are still continuing to fight for liberation from this colonial mindset. And I think that hate is also shaping and perpetuating is the effect of this colonial mindset, right? How the state deal with difference has a history, has a long history in which, you know, queer and trans bodies have been treated by the medical system, by political system, of course, with all the history, by educational system. So I think we need to continue to be mindful that, yes, we are still in the state of colonialism and that hate continues, right? But our resistance also continues. The other side of it too is that hate, when I think about it more deeply as well, it is often kind of, you know, imagine that there is something that is being lost when we fight for trans liberation. Something is lost from normative subjects or citizen subjects. Something is being taken away from heteronormative and cisgender folks when we fight for trans liberation. But that is a fallacy. Right? That is like a wrong mindset. And that's, again, still part of a colonial mindset. Nothing has been taken away from cisnormative, cisgender, and heteronormative folks. Like, we are, as much as we are fighting for trans liberation, we are actually, you know, trying to liberate ourselves from this colonial mentality altogether, right? Mm-hmm. And so my response to the second question in terms of how we combat it is through coalition building. We should continue our resistance. Maybe our resistance is not necessarily within the nation state. We can also have our own collective resistance. I still believe in the power of the arts and how we can retrain and educate our mindset, our cultural imagination, to reimagine and empower people to raise that critical consciousness raising. I still believe, or we still need to be reminded by the women of color, the Black feminists who are foregrounding intersectionality perspective, that our movement today has to be intersectional. It's not just about a fight for queer and trans issues, but also of race and other, you know, markers of difference, including disability justice perspective. So, and also we need to make sure that we are supporting the already existing efforts of queer and trans communities who are helping each other, who become carers of their own community because the nation state doesn't care for them, right? So we need to actually continue to make pressure together collectively to pressure the state to support our struggles, to support our collective efforts. And then our educational system continue to be, you know, integrated out there. So I'm an educator. I continue to bring in queer and trans histories in the curriculum, educating future social workers to increase their competence in regards to queer and trans work. I think we can do this collectively. So combating this issue should be done collectively at different levels using our own, contexts, different roles, maybe people from the government and also people who are outside of political institutions. And I think, that is something that we continue to make efforts fighting towards, liberation. So, mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that, Fritz, because you've given a very great segue to our next question, which we're going to open up to everybody. And that is, how connected are queer rights linked with other human rights movements? So how linked are they with other human rights movements? What more can be done to promote inclusivity in the LGBTQ community? So we're gonna let anybody who wants to jump in on that one, go ahead.
Well, I would like to jump on this one because I think there's a lot of things we can do. And after Fritz's talk, I just want to say there's a lot of great things we can do. Just like me, I did some internship for trans people in the work.
Was a small clip from Rabble's most recent Off the Hill political panel. To watch the entire panel, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.